Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what Xi Jinping wants for China and what that means for the rest of the world. We'll spend this hour with Elizabeth Economy of the Council on Foreign Relations, who says this president, who just 2 months ago managed to eliminate term limits on his leadership, has a vision that includes a stronger than ever Chinese Communist Party and even tighter state control of enterprise. She also seems eager for China to have a greater footprint on the global stage, exporting not only Chinese goods, but Chinese values. Our conversation starts after a short break. Mao Zedong launched his cultural revolution, vowing to purge China of impure elements that had crept in to sully the country's conversion to communist principles. 3 decades later, Deng Xiaoping arrived with his own sweeping changes, a series of economic reforms, and an opening of the country to the world. Now, Xi Jinping holds the reins, possibly for the rest of his life, since he pushed through the removal of presidential term limits, and Xi's vision for China is no less revolutionary than his influential predecessors. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Elizabeth C. Economy is CV Star Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Watching China's development under President Xi's leadership, she has noted his commitment to reviving China's sense of itself as the most important nation on the planet, his commitment to economic growth and global cultural influence, and his urgent desire to strengthen the power and control of the Chinese Communist Party. She joins us from the studios of Houston Public Media to talk about her new book, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Elizabeth, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, very, very much, Chris.
You call it a great paradox that Xi Jinping is trying to position himself as a champion of globalization, but trying to limit the penetration of capital and goods and information into China. What is his long game here?
So I think Xi Jinping has a very different conception of China from that of Deng Xiaoping, for example. He has a vision of a China that is much more ambitious and expansive on the global stage, but also much more insular and repressive and authoritarian at home. And, you know, to your point, that means that while he claims, for example, in his big speech at Davos, that China is going to be a defender and a champion of globalization, he doesn't really mean that China is prepared to let a lot of outside influences, whether capital or ideas or culture, into the country. But he is interested in promoting those things going out from China to the rest of the world.
Help me understand something, because Xi is trying to limit the access that average Chinese citizens have to information from and about the outside world. But China sends large numbers of its most promising students abroad to be educated. Many of those students attend U.S. universities. How can Xi ensure that these students are not changed by what they learn about the democratic West? Why would he allow so many of them to come here?
Well, I think, you know, Chinese students have been coming here for decades now, and the numbers are only growing. Many of them come to study the sciences and engineering. It's still considered in China that the United States is, you know, attracts the best and the brightest for our science and education and engineering education. I think so. It's not necessarily the case that those students are going to be affected greatly by the values and ideals of a democratic society in the United States. But they've also taken steps. Xi Jinping has also taken steps now to try to ensure that the students at U.S. universities remain true to their communist values. You may have been reading that they're setting up communist party cells in many universities and colleges so that the Chinese students can gather, can have weekly or monthly study sessions so that they're still receiving input from China, even though they're studying here. And they're responsible in some cases for watching over and reporting on their fellow students. So even though they're sending, you know, 300,000 students here to the United States, they're still trying to keep track of them to understand what it is that they're saying and what they're doing.
Broadly speaking, Elizabeth, what did China have working for it and against it when Xi Jinping attained the presidency?
So when Xi came to power, you know, China had had a number of successes. It had hosted the Olympics. Its economy was growing at 10 to 12% per year. It had risen on the global stage and become, in many respects, the world's second largest economy. It had surpassed Japan. It's the world's largest trading power. Has the world's largest standing army. So it was, the site of many superlatives. But at the same time, when Xi took power, he looked and he said, look, the Communist Party is confronted with endemic corruption. He very famously said that if corruption could be the death of the Chinese Communist Party and the death of the Chinese state, if it were not addressed. The Communist Party had no compelling ideology, no sense of values. People used the Communist Party as a stepping stone for political and economic advancement. That was one very significant problem. It was facing rampant inequality. At the time Xi came to power, China was a more unequal society than the United States, faced devastating pollution, air, water, and soil contamination. So many of the ills that you would see in a very rapidly developing society anywhere, China was confronting them in spades, and it had 1.4, or 3 billion people to deal with. So there were a lot of social challenges that China faced, as well as a challenge to the ruling Communist Party.
Is it reasonable for Xi to perceive that Deng Xiaoping's opening of China was the first thing to weaken the Chinese Communist Party?
Certainly, I think he believes that an element of that opening of allowing many foreign ideas to come into China. When Xi took power, the internet had become a virtual political space. There were all sorts of debates and discussions about potential political reform. There were challenges being posed to the government on the environment. People were protesting in one province and linking up with other provinces. So Chinese civil society had really expanded and was blossoming, both in terms of non-governmental organizations and also via the internet. And for someone like Xi Jinping, who is more of a true believer, who wanted to strengthen the Chinese Communist Party, that I think he would look at Deng's era and think that that was a significant weakness.
Is there any sign whatsoever that Xi's assertion of his power has anything to do with personal enrichment?
I don't think there's any sign that Xi Jinping is looking for personal economic enrichment via his sort of consolidation of power. But I do think there's an enrichment of his personal power.
Sure.
And I think that's something that he's very driven toward. We've seen, from the very beginning, he's used the anti-corruption campaign to eliminate his political enemies. He's taken control of all of the most important committees and commissions that oversee the sort of large areas of government policy, like cyber or economic reform or national security. And as you mentioned, he's eliminated the two-term limit for presidency. So many things that he's done along the way over the past 5 years have been to enrich his own personal status as a leader of the country. But economically, I don't think so. And if you look at his trajectory through his career as he moved up through the various provinces, one thing that he's always talked about has been corruption. And he's always maintained that officials should never use their political power for personal economic advancement.
So that's how he defines corruption.
Yes.
Okay. You mentioned that he has eliminated some political adversaries. How else is he trying to centralize the power of the Communist Party? And what's the practical effect of that on regular Chinese people who live with and in the Chinese Communist Party?
So I think one element is his consolidation of power, in his own hands, right? So he's reversed Deng Xiaoping's period, where Deng really looked to have a collective leadership. Xi Jinping has reverted more to a Maoist model, where there's one leader clearly at the top. So that's one element of the consolidation of power. But the other is really an enhancement or a strengthening of the Communist Party within Chinese society and within the economy. And you could see that manifested in a number of different ways. Xi Jinping is pushing forward with a very intrusive surveillance system, with facial and voice recognition. Right now, there are about 176 cameras spread throughout, a million cameras spread throughout the country. He wants to take that to 620 more million cameras.
Wow.
Right.
So nearly a billion, excuse me for interrupting you, nearly a billion cameras, surveillance cameras is his goal.
Right. And they're starting, they're stopping people on the street to make them do voice recognition. So they want to be able to listen in on any conversation, be able to identify exactly who's speaking. So that's one element of the more intrusive nature of the party. They're establishing the social credit system, which is a way that the party wants to evaluate the trustworthiness of the Chinese citizenry. And that can be everything from whether they've defaulted on a loan or whether they've jaywalked. You know, any minor petty infraction can be used to assemble this social credit score. And then that score is used either to penalize people. Right. So people who've defaulted on a loan and haven't repaid it right now are banned from flying on an airplane. But people who do good things, right, can be rewarded, for example, by getting preferential access to a top restaurant or preferential access to great schools for their children. So, you know, this is using not only systems of e-payments, right, and recording people's information, but asking people's neighbors to spy on them and report on them on what they're doing. So, again, this is a very much a return to a Maoist era of where the party is penetrating very deeply into society.
A lot of Chinese people suffered under Mao. Are people observing this agenda of Xi Jinping's and alarmed in any way? I know it can be hard to measure public opinion in a place where speaking your mind can get you in trouble.
No, I think you're right. It is hard, and there's not really great polling on Xi Jinping's popularity. There is some. I think people generally, if you look at the broad populace within China, they are very pleased with the anti-corruption campaign because you know they've been the victims of many of the sort of petty activities of local officials, you know, being forced to pay for, you know, a heat for your child to sit next to a heater in a classroom on a cold day, you know, so all sorts of being paid, you know, forced to pay a doctor extra money to get medicine. So they're excited about the anti-corruption campaign. I think some of them are excited that Xi Jinping has said he wants to address inequality in the environment. But there is a lot of consternation about Xi Jinping's consolidation of power in his own hands. There's a lot of nervousness among entrepreneurs about Xi Jinping's desire for the party to take a stake in private Chinese companies, right, to buy a 2% stake and then put a party member on the board of the company. Liberal intellectuals certainly are concerned about all the constraints on the internet and freedoms of speech and writing. So there are fairly significant what I term pockets of discontent within Chinese society that look at sort of Xi's path forward with significant alarm.
When Xi Jinping talks about rejuvenating the Chinese nation, you explain that he's really drawing on kind of a longstanding trope of Chinese culture, which is the sense that China is the greatest, most enlightened society, but fails to get the respect it deserves abroad.
Right. So if you look back through Chinese history, I mean, they've had great thinkers like Confucius and Mencius. They were known, you know, for innovations like paper, the printing press, gunpowder. Xi Jinping looks back, and exploration, I should say, like Zheng He, who was an admiral during the Ming Dynasty. So when Chinese look back, they can see periods of time when China truly was the Middle Kingdom, right? The center of the world, had the largest economy. And Xi Jinping is drawing on that element of Chinese history to say, I want to reclaim, right, that sense of greatness, that sense of centrality on the global stage for contemporary China. And so what he's trying to do is mix together some of those historical elements like Confucius with Marxism and the contemporary Chinese experience and say, you know, we are creating something entirely new, but equally worth, you know, sort of a superpower position on the global stage.
My guest is Elizabeth Economy, CV Star, Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking about her new book, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. We'll be right back. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Elizabeth C. Economy. She's C.V. Starr Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She has a new book out called The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can find us on Twitter at K-E-R-A Think, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. Elizabeth, how did Xi Jinping peg his initial goals for China's evolution to its GDP?
How did he peg the initial goals for China's evolution to GDP?
Yeah, when he wanted China to change, you know, he had some ideas about what the GDP would look like in a matter of years.
I see. Yes, he had said that he wanted China's GDP per capita to double between 2010 and 2020. He is looking to have China become a prosperous country by 2049, and that element of GDP growth was an essential part of that. So roughly it means that between 2015 and 2020, China's GDP needs to grow on average 6.5% per year. And China looks to be on target to achieve that, you know, if in fact you believe the official statistics.
Wrapped up in that goal for economic growth was another goal, which is that China would have the capacity to fight and win wars. Is she also thinking China should be well positioned to start wars if it so chooses?
I think if we look at the past 5 years, Xi Jinping has undertaken a number of important structural reforms to the Chinese People's Liberation Army. He's actually reworked it so that it is much more based on a U.S. model with theater commands. He's working very much on interoperability. We've certainly seen in the South China Sea that Xi Jinping has not only reclaimed land to build up seven little islands that China controls, but also he's militarized them. I think where I would anticipate that Xi Jinping might use force would be if, in fact, he feels as though Taiwan is slipping ever further out of the mainland's orbit. I don't think that Xi Jinping has in his mind a desire to use the military proactively, but I do think if there were a serious threat to reunification over the long time, and that could be the South China Sea or Hong Kong, Macau, or Taiwan, I think that's the one way in which I could see Xi Jinping thinking about using his army proactively.
In terms of reclaiming or in some cases establishing government control over private enterprise, you mentioned that, you know, high-ranking party officials might be given a position within these companies. How does that work in practice? Are they actually doing anything? Are these like patronage jobs in which they're just overseeing these activities? Or is it ultimately really about funneling some profits back to the government?
You know, in point of fact, it's neither. What Xi Jinping wants, whether it's state-owned enterprises, private enterprises, or frankly even joint ventures, I've spoken with a number of business people here in the United States who are involved in joint ventures in China who are concerned about the efforts of the party committees within their joint ventures to assert a much greater role in investment decisions. So what they're really looking for in large part is the party would like to be able to say, you know, we're trying to develop this remote city where nobody wants to live. So we would like your company to develop its manufacturing plant here. Right. Or a company might want to undertake some new investment to do some sort of acquisition. And the party would like the ability, the party committee would like the ability to have the decision, the end decision, the final decision making authority over that investment to be able to say, actually, no, we don't consider that to be a wise decision. And as I was doing the research for the book, in fact, I heard from one former head of an SOE, a state-owned enterprise, who left his position after 20 years because he said the party committee was becoming so active in determining investment decisions, but they knew nothing about the business and refused to accept any responsibility for those decisions after they'd been made. It's really about being able to use these enterprises as arms of sort of state interest.
How are state-owned enterprises empowered to, like, take on big projects abroad in high-risk economies, and what's the effect of that on global competition?
So for many, many years, we've seen state-owned enterprises in China driven by the central government to go out and acquire resources, right? The resources that China needed to grow its economy. Under Xi Jinping, that's shifted a little bit as the Chinese economy has slowed a little bit, as it doesn't have quite so much need for infrastructure development within the country. Xi Jinping has developed the Belt and Road Initiative, and that's really an effort to connect China to the rest of the world through infrastructure, both ports and railroads and highways, but also digital infrastructure, GPS systems and fiber optic cable, e-commerce. And so Xi Jinping is sending state-owned enterprises out to 68 countries and, frankly, now to the entirety of the world to develop these projects. So it could be dam building, construction. Within this Belt and Road Initiative, 89, almost 90% of all the projects are undertaken by Chinese construction firms. So it's a way of China to export its overcapacity and to export its labor, and at the same time meet a global need for infrastructure, because the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank are not able to fill that need alone. There's enormous need for infrastructure development throughout the developing world. So in some measure, China is contributing to a global good, but it's also trying to ensure that it reaps a lot of the economic advantage of doing that.
Well, and aside from the economic advantage, there is a great deal of soft power to be gained with something like the Belt and Road Initiative.
Well, there would be a lot of soft power to be gained if, in fact, the way that China was pursuing these projects was sort of at a better standard. So what we've seen over the past several years is that there's a lot of pushback in many, if not most, of the countries where China is undertaking these Belt and Road projects, whether it's in Pakistan or in Nepal or in Kenya. You know, Kenya got its first coal-fired power plant in an environmentally sensitive area as a result of Chinese investment of, you know, a China Belt and Road project. So there's a lot of public opposition to many of these projects. Why? Because they may not be environmentally sound. The tendering process for the bidding is not transparent. So in some cases, we've seen that local companies underbid Chinese companies, but the leaders in the countries are interested in doing bigger deals with the Chinese government. So the Chinese companies get the deals anyway. So I think, and there's certainly the labor issue, because if you look at globally, if you look at infrastructure projects that are done, you know, Chinese firms only have about 30% and local firms have more than 40%. But in the Belt and Road, as I mentioned, the Chinese firms have about 89% and the local firms get about 7% and international firms about 4%. So that really skews the advantages away from local communities. And so China's soft power with a lot of these Belt and Road projects is not really as great as we might think.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Jay is calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I was calling because I have recently come across some research that talks about how John Cobb at Claremont Theological Institution, I believe is what it's called. He's a process theologian. He's there's a lot of work, or the Chinese seem to have a lot of interest in the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead, and they've opened up like 24 universities focusing on this philosophy and for the goal of becoming the an ecological civilization. And I was just wondering if your guests would be able to comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
So I'm not familiar with these universities that are focused on the development of this of Whitehead's philosophy, but certainly ecological civilization, developing ecological civilization, has been part of the Chinese mantra even before Xi Jinping took power. You know, I think I'm someone who tends to look more at the reality on the ground than on the rhetoric that comes out of the Communist Party. And so I think if you take the area where China has pushed hardest, where the Xi Jinping government has pushed hardest to address its environmental challenges, namely air quality, I think you find that basically the problem is being addressed in the some of the wealthy coastal cities. But as you move into the interior parts of China and the western provinces, you see that pollution levels are rising. Hmm. And you also see that China is exporting, for example, its coal-fired power plants. And the coal-fired power plants that it's exporting abroad, there are almost 200 associated with the Belt and Road Initiative, for example, are not the top-level quality, not the ultra-supercritical coal-fired power plants that, for example, Japan exports. So I think there is a sort of a gap between China's desire to create or to call itself committed to an ecological civilization and the reality on the ground.
It does seem that as, you know, more people move up sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs into middle class status, which is happening in China, that people start to pay attention and even in a place like China demand those environmental reforms. Is there a lot of activity there and how much is that tolerated?
No, absolutely. In fact, if you look back to 2011 and 2012, the environment was the largest source of social unrest in the country. So the last date for which we have protests in China was 2010, and there were 180,000 protests then. So the majority of those were around the environment. The environment was also a big source of discussion on the internet. And right when Xi Jinping took power, people were calling on the internet for the government to do something about the air pollution. The U.S. Embassy had been tweeting the air pollution statistics, so the Chinese now knew just how bad their air quality was. And you had billionaires and others saying, we demand change now. And so even when Xi Jinping came into power, the initial response of the government was, it took a long time for the pollution to get to this point. It's going to take a long time for us to respond to it. So give us 30 years. And the Chinese people said, nah, that's a little too long for us because, 1.6 million people are dying prematurely every year from air pollution in China. So they pushed hard on this issue, and the Chinese government began to respond. So the environment continues to be a source of social unrest and social pressure in the country. I think it is exactly as you say, as the Chinese people get wealthier, they respond very much like societies everywhere else. They want clean air, they want good education, they want good life for their children, they want the ability to have their voices heard, to influence policy. They're no different than people everywhere else.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour with Elizabeth C. Economy, who is Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her new book is called The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Back to the phones now. We have Frank calling from Burleson. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Last week, there was a report that President Trump released a Twitter that they were going to invoke the tariffs on companies that were dealing with Iran the same as if they were Iran. And one of the largest electronic firms in China, ZTE, came out and said that if they had to meet those tariffs, that they were very probably going to go out of business, releasing thousands of workers. Then I heard that there was a report that President Trump says, oh, I'm going to get those jobs back for ZTE.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Frank. Can you give us some perspective on all that, Elizabeth?
Sure. So ZTE is an enormous electronics company in China, and they were accused and convicted by the United States of providing technology to both Iran and North Korea. They were sanctioned, and they promised that they were going to fire the people responsible. The United States recently, the Trump administration recently said they didn't fulfill the promise to fire those people. And so they said that ZTE could no longer buy component parts from the United States or couldn't have any dealings with U.S. companies. That, in effect, would put ZTE out of business. Now, President Trump, just this past weekend, tweeted that, in fact, yes, he wasn't going to instruct the U.S. Commerce Department to sort of relieve some of the pressure on ZTE, to try to find a way that ZTE basically could continue to exist because there were too many Chinese jobs at stake. This is a very odd decision on the part of the president because, you know, this was a sort of a signal blow. And it was part of the broader set of trade negotiations and sort of pushing China to the brink that the president seemed to be undertaking. And yet when he let the Chinese off the hook in this very public way, it's unclear what it is that the United States is getting in return. What I've heard is that there's an agreement on agriculture, that the Chinese are going to lift the tariffs on soybeans and pork. But that basically takes us back to the status quo. It's where we started. So why did the president, in fact, begin all of this tariff war if he didn't have a broader objective in mind? I think the one hope that we can have at this point is that China is sending its chief trade negotiator, Liu He, very important economist in China. I think he arrived today, even in Washington, for a multi-day set of negotiations on trade and investment. So I think the hope is that this ZTE decision is part of a much broader set of decisions that have already been agreed upon and are going to be announced over the course of the next few days. Otherwise, frankly, it doesn't make much sense.
My guest is Elizabeth C. Economy, CV Star Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her new book is called The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Elizabeth Economy of the Council on Foreign Relations, where she is Director for Asia Studies. Her new book is called The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Something else that Xi Jinping is working on in a concerted way, Elizabeth, is exporting Chinese values. It's not just about goods and services. Tell us about Confucius Institutes, which are operating all over the United States, but may not be familiar to everybody listening.
Sure. Confucius Institutes and Confucius Classrooms, there are about 500 of them in the United States, and some of them are attached to universities, some of them are standalone institutions, and some of them might just be a classroom within an elementary or high school. And they are basically offering Chinese language instruction and oftentimes lectures, cultural events, and they're funded by the Chinese government. They've come under scrutiny in recent months by the U.S. Congress because there are constraints on these Confucius Institutes. So the teachers are selected by mainland China. The curriculum is developed by mainland China. And there are concerns, in fact, that, you know, in having these kind of control by Beijing over what American students are being taught and the way that they're being taught, that in some way they're limiting, you know, freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And indeed, you know, you're not going to be able to have, for example, an advanced class in newspaper Chinese where you're going to be discussing sensitive political issues. So I think there are legitimate concerns about having the Chinese government basically controlling Chinese language instruction in universities or high schools or even elementary schools.
So what would be an appropriate action for the United States to take in response to that?
I think there are a couple of different ways to approach this. One would be to move the Confucius Institutes off campuses, where they would become more like Alliance Française or the Goethe Institutes, which are, you know, French and German language and cultural institutions that are, you know, independent. People can elect to go study Chinese, knowing that they're getting Chinese government books and teachers, but they know that, right? That would mean that the U.S. government would probably have to step in and help fund Chinese language instruction in many places, however, because a lot of universities and schools simply don't have the financial resources to offer Chinese. So that, you know, I think when we're hearing all these calls from Congress, that means that they really should step in and offer the other half of that. The other thing you could do would be to say to the Chinese government, we are delighted that you want to support Chinese language instruction and cultural exchanges and lectures, but you can't control the curriculum and the teachers. So please do fund these activities, but the universities themselves will choose the teachers and the curriculum. So I think that's another way to approach this. I think there's also the issue that there's no reciprocity here. So there are only three American centers or corners that are based in China. And there are a few sort of English language institutes based at universities, but nowhere near the opportunity for the United States to deploy English language, American culture, and educational opportunities and lectures at Chinese universities. So I think that issue of reciprocity is also something that should be considered.
How challenging is it for regular people to bypass China's controls on access to content that the Chinese Communist Party deems inappropriate?
It traditionally has been reasonably easy. People use virtual private networks. You know, most Chinese young people are able to get around the Great Firewall, read things that the Chinese government does not want them to read. The Chinese government announced in January that it was going to shut down, however, all virtual private networks that were not controlled by the Chinese government. And this sent a chill because then all the content that would be going in and out would be under Chinese government control. They haven't done this yet. It was supposed to happen March 31st, but for whatever reason, that has not transpired. There was enormous pushback, of course, from multinationals who said they didn't want their data, their sensitive data, flowing through Chinese networks. And by the way, the internet in China is extremely slow, and this would only slow it down more. So there was a lot of pushback there. I don't know whether that's partially responsible for why the Chinese government hasn't enacted this new regulation, but it is out there. You know, Xi Jinping, the Chinese government, are very determined to limit as much as possible access to information for the Chinese people that is considered politically out of bounds.
All right, let's jump back to the phones now. This time we have JP calling from Austin. Hi, JP.
Yes, thank you for calling me. I'm going to call. I just wanted to ask your speaker a comment about the China expansionism map, how popular it is over there, and how they've been told to this, you know, the Chinese people, because it kind of a smokescreen to cover all the bad thing that government does, because it, you know, raised up the nationalism, and they don't care what they do, the government does, you know, this powerful China. As a matter of fact, yesterday in Vietnam, there's a group of tourists walking around with a map and a T-shirt. It's a real blatant, you know, a violation of international law, but I'm not sure if you can comment how the government talk to them, how people react, and then how the international community want to do about this.
Thanks for calling.
So the question is how the Chinese government manages maps?
I think it was how, let's go back to JP and find out. You're talking about how regular Chinese people, JP, feel about China's plans for expansionism. Is that right?
Yes. Well, how the people, how the government talk to them, and then how they feel about it.
Okay, thank you.
I see, thank you. So in general, the Chinese government has, you know, for decades instilled in the Chinese people that sovereignty over the South China Sea, Taiwan and Hong Kong and Macau is that achieving, moving from staking claims to realizing them is only a matter of time. So the vast majority of people in China believe that, you know, 80 to 90% of the South China Sea, as well as Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan, belong to China. So there's not much debate within China over this. There's a little bit, but not very much. So I think the Chinese government can tap into nationalism when they need to. This idea of Chinese sovereignty is very deeply ingrained in sort of the Chinese political culture. In fact, when I was in China about 5 weeks ago, I was meeting with a number of senior think tank analysts and officials, and they were all, you know, talking about President Trump's tariffs, and they were talking about President Trump's plans to meet the president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. But what actually they were most concerned about was the fact that President Trump had signed into law the Taiwan Travel Act. And the Taiwan Travel Act is a law that basically just says we will encourage or we will permit senior U.S. officials to meet with senior Taiwanese officials. And for many of the Chinese, this was a red line that the United States had crossed. Not to mention the fact that we've agreed now to sell Taiwan the license so that they can build their own attack submarines. So when they see the United States meddling in areas of what they consider to be Chinese sovereignty, that, you know, stirs sort of nationalist forces.
Does Xi's agenda pose a threat to other independent powers in Asia? I wonder what, you know, China's sovereign neighbors think about Xi Jinping and his ideas.
I think there's been an enormous step up on the part of Japan, in India, even Australia, certainly Vietnam, efforts to push back against China. So if you look at the Belt and Road Initiative, Japan and India have established their own coordinated effort in Africa called the Africa Growth Corridor, Economic Growth Corridor. When a Chinese company Huawei was going to lay the fiber optic cables as part of the Belt and Road from the Solomon Islands to Australia, the Australians said, no, we'll take care of that for you. There were rumors about a Chinese base in Vanuatu, and the Australians said, not interested in having a Chinese base in Vanuatu. The Indians have been very concerned about China's growing role in Nepal, in Sri Lanka, and the Maldives, areas where India has traditionally played a significant role. So they're starting to become activated. You know, and Vietnam and Japan have always had significant security concerns around Vietnam, the South China Sea, and Japan around the East China Sea. So I think there's a lot of agitation in the region about China's rising power and a lot of concern over whether or not the United States is going to continue to be the significant presence that it traditionally has been, given President Trump's America First policy and his desire sort of to take a step back from many of the responsibilities, both in terms of regional leadership, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and global leadership on issues like climate change. So I think the, you know, Asian middle and larger powers are having to fill a vacuum, fill a space that the United States might previously have occupied.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Can you talk about what we should understand about the personal relationship between President Trump and President Xi? Things that may not be evident simply from watching the handshakes that happen on TV and reading Twitter.
I think it's quite an interesting relationship. President Trump clearly has a great deal of personal admiration for President Xi Jinping, and I think he is potentially a little bit envious of President Xi's ability to control the media and to eliminate, you know, two terms of a presidency. You know, it may be best to call it at this point a one-sided bromance. There's not much evidence that President Xi Jinping looks upon President Trump with the same degree of admiration and affection. I think there's a sense that the U.S. president is somewhat impulsive and unpredictable. I think there are elements of The fact that President Trump has surrounded himself, you know, with relatives in the government, there, you know, sort of a little bit of corruption surrounding a number of the political appointments that President Trump has made. So in many respects, these are exactly the types of things that President Xi has been trying to address in China to deal with. And so I think it's hard to imagine that he doesn't look at President Trump at some points and think that his governing style is not one that probably resonates very deeply with President Xi.
How different will the world look a decade from now if Xi Jinping's plans go as expected?
You know, I think the Belt and Road Initiative, for example, has the potential to be transformative, both, you know, geostrategically and geoeconomically. China already controls 76 ports in 35 countries. And despite saying that these are for commercial use only, we've seen in a number of instances that PLA Navy ships have stopped by for visits after China takes control of the ports. You know, Xi Jinping is out there pushing, you know, Chinese values in African countries, Latin American countries, Southeast Asia, training officials on how to manage populations, how to, you know, deal with propaganda. These are the kinds of things that, you know, then will redound back up in terms of global governance. So, you know, Xi Jinping will have allies when he looks to change norms on human rights or when he's pushing for a Chinese vision of internet sovereignty. He will be able to call on a number of countries to support him in ways that, you know, previously were not the case. And so I think it is possible that you'll see, you know, Chinese GPS systems and e-commerce and fiber optic cables and railroads setting the technological and technical standards of the future if the Belt and Road Initiative comes to full fruition. And it's possible that you'll see international institutions more closely reflecting Chinese values and policy priorities and ideals than American ones. So if Xi Jinping sort of can redesign the world, you know, he said back in 2014, he wants China not only to be able to help contribute to write the rules of the game, but to construct the playgrounds on which the games are played. I think if he's able to achieve that, the world will look very different from the way it does today.
Elizabeth C. Economy is C.V. Starr Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her new book is called The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Elizabeth, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is Technical Director. Samantha Guzman is Associate Producer. Jeff Whittington is Executive Producer. You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. My Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast or go straight to our website. That's think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.